listening to A Stranger Podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Hi, Josh.
Hey there.
Are you in Eugene?
I am in Eugene.
Okay, all right, which is where you live, teach, work, all that stuff. And last week you were here in Seattle?
Yes, that's correct. We lucked out with the weather. It was beautiful. It was sunny the whole time, which was really kind of strange. Or it was mostly sunny the whole time.
Well, we made up for it early this week. I missed you at the Betty Bowen talk that you gave, but congratulations. You are the winner of this year's Betty Bowen Award.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I wanted to hear, that means that you have a work on display at Seattle Art Museum. I've always felt that I wish the Betty Bowen winners would have kind of a big show, or a bigger show. but you do have one work on display outside the elevators on the third floor of Seattle Art Museum. And I wanted to talk to you, just start off by talking about that work, since that's something that people have been seeing.
Sure.
In Seattle. The work is called Endless Night, and why don't you talk a little bit about it? It's 2000.
Sure. and it's a bunch of raggedy fabric on a palette. The piece is called Endless Night, and actually, in a lot of ways, it makes sense that this particular piece is up as opposed to some of my other pieces, just because this is a piece that I made about a year ago, actually exactly a year ago, that I exhibited at a space called Front Room Gallery in Cleveland. And it kind of influenced a large percentage of the work that I'm now making. So I think it was kind of a real turning point in my studio practice in a lot of ways. It was a way that I was kind of able to synthesize stuff that I'd been doing in the past with kind of a somewhat new direction of how I wanted things to be going. And so the piece itself is, I guess to just describe it most formally, it's kind of a series of crocheted afghans that have been, they kind of take the afghan form. They're kind of these rectilinear type forms, and they're stretched over these found garden trellises. And each afghan is dipped in a vat of indigo dye, which is successively darker than the next one. And then in the kind of corner, on the other side of the other wall, is kind of a derelict version of this afghan, kind of a failed attempt that's been bound in a ribbon that is embroidered that says "Not Your Bag," and it's flanked by this separate panel that is a kind of a machine knit fabric that has a little candle that's kind of illuminating the way or leaving the light on for this starry derelict afghan that can kind of barely stand on its own. So in many ways, the piece is kind of takes on this personified presence or something, this substitute performer for a kind of loneliness or for that kind of moment of staring out the window, like in the middle of the night and, watching out the night sky and kind of waiting for something to happen in kind of this space of inevitable kind of desolation or loneliness. So the actual image itself is rather abstract, but it was appropriated from a needlework pattern that I found. So
the image of the candle.
The whole thing. So there's kind of like the larger trellises, the kind of 4x8 feet trellises, have this kind of abstract image that if you kind of stand back a bit, you see what kind of looks like a pixelated version of, if you were like inside of a house and you were looking out the window and it's kind of framed by this like iconic, window curtain or something. And it was this tiny, tiny, 1 inch by 1 inch needlework pattern that I found in like this DIY kind of 70s, craft manual in like a thrift store. And then I just kind of thought about it for a while, and they had one that was in the daytime and I think it said good morning, and there was one that was in the nighttime and it said good evening, and it was supposed to be embroidered onto a hand towel or something. And I'd kind of been looking at this kind of cross stitch pattern for a while and thinking about how bizarre it was, like, you know, why you would, you know, there's something about the image itself that seemed so incredibly lonely and sad and somewhat kind of pathetic. So I figured if I kind of blew it up and somehow kind of monumentalized it, then it would kind of shift, or that it would have kind of a different read, or that I could kind of amplify that tension between it being kind of heroic in one moment and like kind of pathetic and kind of depressed on the other.
Yeah. Reading the interview with you and that the Museum of Contemporary Craft did,
mm-hmm.
and you talked about, you know, kind of teaching a class on art and queer theory, and that
mm-hmm.
a lot of the students didn't have a background and kind of came to it with this funny resistance at the beginning, but then sort of at the end were like, I think everybody is queer, and you were sort of like, I'm not sure that's what I intended either.
Exactly.
So, you know, I guess, you know, the legibility question is the big question. You know, like how legible can queerness be without being shut down? You know, or being.
Well, that is like, yeah, that's totally a central question, and I think maybe that's a reason that keeps me invested in the materials and the way that I work in materials and the way that I teach, and it becomes kind of a pedagogical question. I think that. I've been kind of spinning around a lot of these ideas actually really recently, but so they're very kind of new and somewhat ill-formed. But I think that I see this definite parallel between the way that there's been this kind of struggle over the past couple of decades over kind of representations of sexuality or sexual difference or queerness or whatever, that in some ways kind of affirms a collective identity, but doesn't necessarily kind of essentialize an individualized identity. So, you know, like, obviously, like, we kind of live in a time where we're no longer kind of bound to these kind of historic codes or tropes or signifiers or things that, you know, were once like a very kind of condemning set of iconography. You know, it's like we don't all kind of believe in like Joan Crawford and like Katie Lang and et cetera, you know, but like at the same time, like there's something about the power of that history and the power of kind of claiming a set of claiming a vernacular for oneself, just so that you feel somewhat kind of tethered or bound historically to a kind of political identity, I guess, or that you somehow have like a political platform to stand on. And when kind of those icons or that iconography kind of gets taken away or becomes fluid, then you kind of deal with issues of representation or kind of how do you represent oneself. And so in a parallel sense, there's kind of a similar existential crisis in kind of craft communities or in kind of the role of textiles in art, and there's kind of this sense that on the one hand, people that use kind of textiles are, you know, have, since the 70s have kind of used it as a way of bringing out the kind of political possibilities or the political charge of that textiles kind of have embedded within them, you know, histories of sexuality, histories of gender, histories of labor, you know, multicultural histories. And so as kind of a lot of that, those histories get adopted into or accepted into kind of a more sculptural discourse, I think a lot of those nuances get somewhat emptied out just because, you know, sculpture has kind of subsumed that as a kind of viable material to now use. And so it's kind of gets me thinking a lot about this kind of relationship of how you can kind of imbue anything with a sense of queerness, or how, you know, in my case, like textiles, or how craft-based practices can still kind of retain their sense of authority. It's this weird thing where
what kind of authority do you mean?
Well, I think like where it can still kind of serve as kind of the underdog in a
right.
sense.
So the
you know,
where
you,
almost.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
I said the anti-authority almost.
Yeah, exactly. Like where it's, yeah, exactly. Where it can still kind of have that liminal status, you know? So it's this strange thing where there's this bizarre power dynamic that happens where on one hand, we seek to kind of, to gain acceptance and authority through the materials that we use, or queer people are obviously seeking visibility, but then there's this kind of question of assimilation and what happens at that moment of assimilation. So you can kind of apply that discourse to what happens when the discourse of textiles assimilates itself into the discourse of sculpture and painting, mm-hmm. or what happens when, you know, queerness gets assimilated into kind of a normative kind of heterosexual society. So it's like, you know, so I think there's kind of an interesting parallel there that I'm not sure if I've completely articulated, but it's kind of something on my mind.
Mm-hmm. And the one of my favorite things you said is sculpture is an imperialist force.
Yeah. Right. I know. I think we were really drinking too much coffee then or something like that, but we got all carried away.
That's the name for your memoir.
I hope not.
Well, can you talk to me about some of the other work, some of the work we can't see? I'm really interested in your use of kind of like activism, the materials of activism, pins and books and things like that. Actually, like, included right on the surface of your textiles.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about triage?
Triage is a piece that I created for a show this past summer at Lisa Cooley Gallery. And it's a series of hand-woven hemp fabrics that have been kind of stitched together in this kind of kente cloth-like format. So it kind of resembles the way that, like, kind of, in some ways, very loosely, how, like, kind of African ceremonial kente cloth is sewn together in kind of these, like, strips. And a lot of the kind of patterning that you see in the image is done with kind of a bastardized ikat process with nail polish. So, you know, there's always kind of this warp and weft to any woven fabric. There's a series of horizontal threads and a series of vertical threads that intersect. And so all of the vertical threads are stretched, and then I've painted them with this pattern with nail polish, and then it's woven, so it gives this kind of shifty patterned look. And then attached to that are, you know, these kind of series of woven pockets. And within the pockets are a number of kind of self-help books, political pins, and so forth. And so, and at the front of the piece is this handmade sign that I actually found on the Oregon coast that was made by a guy who had just passed away, and they were kind of liquidating, and it's...
Say again, you're saying it.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
So,
you said made by a guy who had just passed away, and they were liquidating.
They were selling all of his woodcrafts, and he was this guy that kind of hand carved all of these signs and made all these kind of tchotchkes and trinkets. And so, one of the things that he carved was the sign that I bought that said "This place is for the birds." And so, I thought there was a certain kind of emotional resonance or kind of sadness to this whole story of him kind of recently passing away, and then, like, this is kind of the last thing that he had, you know, or one of the last things that was being sold was this kind of, it was this sign. So I kind of included it. And I guess as a whole, the piece is in some ways like an homage or memorial, but I think that the kind of object is somewhat confused. It's kind of difficult to tell who's really being memorialized or what's being memorialized. And triage kind of refers to the way that crises are, you know, obviously tended to in kind of an emergency situation. Mm. I used to work on a crisis and suicide hotline when I was a teenager. And so I always remember that as like you had to like figure out who was the most suicidal and you had to kind of like triage the calls that way. So there was something about that kind of that relationship of, you know, like a textile, making a textile or making a fabric that somehow had an emergency or an urgency attached to it was really interesting, and that it was kind of trying to call for help in some way.
Mm-hmm. Where are you from?
I'm from St. Louis.
Mm. And what is your background like?
My background, I grew up in suburbs. It was very banal, very much like, you know, I said in the lecture that I think most of my experience growing up was, you know, framed by our nosy neighbors trying to get my parents arrested for pumping toxic chemicals into their backyard. Like, it was a very kind of cul-de-sac kind of neighborhood.
Were they pumping toxic chemicals in the backyard?
Well, you know, yeah, it's like people that watch way too much. No, they weren't, but like it was just like people who are just like watching way too much Dateline NBC, you know? And it's like this idea that like normalcy is like always, there's this always present threat of something kind of throwing the balance of normalcy off, you know?
Like, yeah, yeah.
Everything's, like, really quiet and serene, but, like, there's something lurking that's, like, going to kind of undermine everything and undo everything. And so I think, you know, so I think that was kind of the existence of my growing up. I mean, it was, like, totally normal, but then there were these, like, really weird things that my parents or that the people around them were just terrified of, you know, like sexual predators or like toxic chemicals in their backyard or like just like very blown out kind of media things. Mm-hmm. And so, we lived in, you know, it was like a very kind of 60s construction with a lot of kind of, you know, the wood paneled basement and a lot of the kind of early 70s accoutrements.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1979. So actually, it was all kind of the leftovers.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to school where?
I went to school at Oberlin College in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
I studied art history and English.
Right.
And then I moved to New York, and I was working in publishing. I worked for a magazine called Nest, which was an interiors magazine that doesn't exist anymore, unfortunately. But I think in many ways that's what really sparked my interest in interiors or in thinking about textiles in a lot of ways, just because that magazine thought about a psychological way that people really decorate their space. It wasn't just kind of Architectural Digest. It was like kind of juxtaposing these really high-end mansions with like images of the way that the death chambers or like, you know, how like prisons kind of decorate or how they decorate their kind of death chambers, which is a really kind of strange juxtaposition. But so I think that just that experience kind of made me start thinking about textiles in a different way. And I had always been a kind of avid summer camp goer. So I learned how to actually weave and knit and crochet before I ever really learned to draw. And so so I think I kind of had that stored in my memory bank somewhere. And I was really fascinated by like going to the Chelsea flea market every weekend and picking up these like pamphlets that were like easy to make macrame pot holders or plant hangers and, you know, crocheting for the first time and these like really ridiculous kind of craft manuals. But, you know, within them, there's always this kind of like these pictures that seem so highly staged. I mean, they are highly staged and there's something kind of visually crazy or somewhat maniacal about those images when you look at them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And you'd originally learned to do that kind of textile work from your grandmother, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she is still like a pretty avid knitter, and my great grandmother was a crazy, amazing crocheter. So, so I think that was definitely something I grew up around.
I worry what's going to happen when people lose these grandparents who'd crochet and knit. You know, when generations come, it's just, I keep running into artists who have the same kind of beginning experience. And can you talk to me about who makes your work and what how you think about that? Because you've said it's important to you that you kind of challenge the way that craft is so associated with a single author, a single owner of the authoring process.
Yeah. Well, craft by nature, I think, always has there's something somewhat different about craft-based techniques in the sense that I think in terms of textiles, there's always been a kind of communal aspect to it. If you think about quilt circles or you think about the Names Project, you know, there's always, there's always kind of a camaraderie, I think, there, and a community that's associated with textile production. But I think in my work, I'm not sure exactly how to answer that. I mean, I make a lot of the work, but I also employ the use of assistants as well. And a lot of times we'll make the work together. So it's not so much that, and I think that a lot of people outsource work for the sole purpose of using kind of a skilled labor. And I think sometimes I'll kind of have assistants work with me that kind of basically know the techniques, but are still have kind of relatively shaky or nervous hands. And so on one level, they're learning, but I think I also really like that kind of the aesthetic of kind of the unskilled hands touching it. In some ways, kind of outsourcing a DIY aesthetic, if that kind of makes sense. So I guess there's a kind of strange irony there. But I wouldn't so much say it's outsourced because I think, you know, they're oftentimes in my studio working side by side with me. So, and a lot of times I just use assistants because the work is so labor intensive and it just requires somebody, an extra pair of hands to kind of touch the material. But I'm very careful about, you know, like I don't want an expert quilter, an expert crocheter to kind of help me out just because I feel like it becomes, you know, it loses a lot of the kind of tension that I try to create with the work.
What about as you become better?
No, darn, well, right? I mean, that's always the question. I'm kind of curious as to what's going to happen. You know, like I look at the art fabric movement of the early 70s, artists like Ed Rosbach or Sheila Hicks or Walter Nottingham, and you know, a lot of those artists came from really skilled tapestry backgrounds or like really skilled variety of kind of craft backgrounds, and so and their work on the one hand looks very kind of expressive and kind of messy sometimes, but I don't think it ever really loses that. I mean, it never really becomes too polished. And so I think that, you know, so a lot of the newer work I'm making, like, you know, I definitely think, like, okay, I know how to crochet, and it's not like a sloppy kind of endeavor or anything, but I think I still try and keep that kind of expressivity in the work. And I think there's just, I don't know. I mean, it's, I'm not sure if that's necessary. I mean, it's strange because I think if you talk about it from the kind of history of art, excluding kind of craft-based media, that idea is not new at all, you know? And even within kind of crafts, you know, that idea of kind of letting threads be articulate is something that even kind of Annie Elbers talks about. So it's strange that now there's this kind of discussion where crafts are kind of equated with skill and You know, if you work in textile media, you kind of, there's this kind of assumption that all of your selvages have to be neat and everything. So, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe I don't have so much of an interest in being sloppy as I do just kind of trying to let the kind of material be as honest as it possibly can, which is kind of a weird thing to say, but that it that I'm kind of just using the kind of construction very loosely, but I don't necessarily need the kind of manicuring of that construction.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a show, actually. I'm tentatively calling it How to Beat the High Cost of Living, which is a movie made in 1980 with Jessica Lange and Eugene, where they rob a shopping center. But I'm working on a solo show in New York.
Textiles on trellises that lean?
Some of them are. I'm trying to get things off the wall. I mean, it's kind of a cross that I bear. No, I, you know, some things lean, some things are actually stretched on linen and stitched down. So some things look extremely formal, and some things are, there's kind of these spray-painted textiles that I do. There's some woven stuff. I think a lot of it incorporates the use of indigo. I think that was the kind of one unifying thing that I used within this show. Indigo is this really amazing dye that has all of these kind of alchemistic properties and mythologies surrounding it. Mm-hmm. And so the more I read about this dye and all of its kind of folklore, the more interested I became in trying to kind of bring it into this more contemporary discourse. And so, a lot of the work that's in this show kind of has been drowned in indigo, you know, and I think it kind of automatically takes on this very saddened look.
Mm. What about the piece You Can't Live Scared? That's a piece with shade hemp and
yes.
But also Super 8 film. What is, I would love to see that here. Why are you laughing?
No, it's just funny because I've gotten in a lot of trouble for that piece, actually.
Oh, really?
It's a piece that I showed a year ago, and it's basically two parts. There's a large crocheted wall hanging that's black, and it's been spray painted black, but it's also dyed in a variety of kind of dark natural dyes. And it has a pin that, it used to say no longer alone, but now it says, don't bother me, I can't cope, or something like that.
Okay.
And it's hanging next to, or on one wall, next to this other wall where there's a Super 8 video that's being projected. And it's kind of looks like somewhere in between Silence of the Lambs and like a really crude, a webcam video or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's me in a bathtub in kind of quasi-drag, and mm-hmm. I'm walking to the bathtub, getting in the bathtub, and then reciting or trying to recite this really explicit, super dirty personal ad that I found online. And I'm constantly trying to recite it, but I'm never syncing myself up completely to the sound in the video. So there's this kind of frantic kind of editing job that happens where the sound is constantly trying to sync itself up to my lips and I'm trying to kind of catch up to the sound. I think a lot of that piece was thinking about the kind of staginess of the performance of kind of a very intimate space, you know, that there's this kind of strange disconnect between the way that we perform kind of ritual in our kind of own domestic spaces and the way that we kind of enact a performance or that we could potentially be fabulous or whatnot outside of our own domestic space. So it was just kind of, I think that a lot of That piece particularly, that black piece, started influencing a lot of those pieces on trellises with the pins, with, you know, a lot of the stuff on trellises. So it's kind of been an evolution from that piece as well.
Mm-hmm. What have you gotten from teaching? Because, you know, you're sort of in the art world, but at the same time, you're in Eugene, and,
totally.
You know, and you were
definitely
you're at
not in the art world. teaching. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, how are you piecing it all together and kind of, figuring out what you're getting from the teaching world to bring to the
art.
Just sort of the way that you were at the Fashion Institute and decided you didn't want to be in the design world, but that's a place, that's still a kind of a touchstone place.
Yeah. Teaching is, it's actually a kind of incredible thing. And I think the fact that teaching took me to Eugene, Oregon is particularly interesting just because a lot of the techniques that I was quoting when I lived in Chicago, which is where I moved from, a lot of those techniques really kind of they're not really practiced anywhere except for kind of these small communities in the Northwest, you know? So I think that there's something about the kind of culture of weavers' guilds and indigo dyers out in the middle of the woods or something that really fascinates me. There's kind of this like oogly boogly aspect of it that's kind of really exciting. But I think that teaching is a really great way to at once kind of learn new techniques and teach them at the same time and try and kind of synthesize relationships between what you're kind of learning on the spot and how you're kind of presenting them. I think that's really exciting. I think that a lot of times the art world, like if you put it in quotation marks, isn't necessarily all that concerned with kind of intellectual properties, you know, especially like the commercial art world. So I think it's nice to kind of be able to have access to a lot of different communities and
the art world to material, always, of course.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it can be. I think I'm done with my soapbox, but I think that no. But you know, I mean, the art world is a very specific kind of location, and so I think it's really nice to be able to feed a studio practice in a number of different ways, you know, and to feel like, feel like there's a lot of things that are kind of going on, and I think being in Eugene has really helped me sustain a studio practice. If we're looking at it merely from practicality, like just the fact that I'm able to have this like really huge studio space and I can kind of work with all of these materials that I wouldn't necessarily have access to. So I think that I think there is something about the kind of specificity of being here that is really important to the work that I make.
It struck me that you said the words urgency and emergency, and I wanted to ask about, you said in your interview with the Museum of Contemporary Craft that your students get annoyed because you teach textile with political urgency, and I wanted to ask about the political role of these works. How do they function as political works? Do they function as political works?
Well, I don't know if they necessarily, like, function as, like, I mean, I would never say, like, oh, well, I don't need to protest because I make this artwork or whatever, you know. But I think that, I think if you think about issues of representation as a political act, then, you know, or a political issue, then I guess I would say the work is political. I think that I'm invested in, research around queer theory, research around textile history, and all of that kind of marginal history that's been surfaced through kind of the emergence of textile history. And so I think that, I guess that's what I mean by kind of politics. And I think a lot of the work that I make, sorry, there's a train coming through here, so it's going to be kind of loud. But you get a real sense of Eugene now. But I think, you know, a lot of the work I make really quotes or is invested in those kind of early 70s art fabric pieces. And so I think that by kind of appropriating some of those forms or somehow conflating textile history or fabric art history with my own personal history and with a social and political history, that somehow that has a kind of political charge or a political resonance, even though there's kind of a I'm kind of confusing or leaping between decades or leaping between, it's kind of a false sense of nostalgia or something. But I think that for me, nostalgia isn't just kind of a sentimental act. It is one that's about kind of, it's maybe about kind of rethinking the past or misremembering the past in a way that could maybe be reconfigured for, you know, for the future or something like that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, that sounds so nice. I don't want to ask you anything more.
Okay.
I guess just thank you so much for taking the time to do this. Oh. And for everyone who's listening, Josh Fott's work is at Seattle Art Museum. He's the winner of the Betty Bone Award. And thank you for listening.